Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. This is Elizabeth with Washoe County. We're just waiting to get going, so I'm going to go back on mute.
No problem. I'll join you on the mute.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, Marcia. How are you, girl?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Just hanging out. Keeping life.
Nice fourth.
Say it again.
Did you have a nice fourth?
Oh, yeah. Just relaxed with my babe. Got to do a few things and hang out with some neighbor friends.
That's good. Sounds like a fun day.
It was. What'd you do?
About the same. Just kind of laid around in the swimming pool and, you know, barbecued some spare ribs and visited with my children and that kind of stuff.
No, it's very good. It has been good. I mean, I feel like we get to be on Zoom meetings and sit back and watch things happen. It's kind of a weird.
Yeah.
Definitely a weird time.
Definitely weird, yeah. Yeah, very, very interesting that the way that, shall we say, meeting times have changed, huh?
Yeah.
Meeting style has changed.
Yeah, and I don't know that we'll be back in person for a while.
I don't either. I would be surprised if we get out of phase two this year.
I know.
Which is, you know, scary, but probably important for us to make sure we do what we can do to stay safe, you know. There.
How's county fun going? You guys doing okay? I mean, I know you're doing what we're doing, just kind of probably getting through everything.
Yeah, we're really just trying to get through it right now. But, you know, I think things, generally speaking, are going well. But, you know, it is what it is, so gotta play through the game. You're not up for election this year, are you?
I was. I am, but the person, no one ran against me. So.
Oh, good. Oh, nice.
So it makes for a very nice.
Yeah, I wish I was in that boat.
I somebody was running against me and they dropped out. So,
oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that would be nice.
I can't say that I wasn't very excited. We were like, whoa, you know.
Yeah. It's a crazy time to run an election because you can't do the usual walking in the neighborhoods and, you know.
What are you supposed to do? Just do the best, put some signs up, do a few things, whatever.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Social media, signs, probably do some TV, you know.
Mailers do, but the weird thing, too, is if they're doing where everyone can vote from home, well, that changes it, too.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of commitment to the voting, and so people I don't know. It becomes one of those things. Who do you mail? Did you mail to everybody because everyone can vote now or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you'd have to do, mail everybody. Yeah. And I actually think it's cheaper to do commercials.
Yeah.
than it is to do mail, because you can do pretty much everybody on email, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than dropping through the mail, I think it's, there's something to be said for just doing it.
You definitely compete with mailers if that's the case too. People will get, I know I get all the mailers and I don't tell all these people, but I throw them away. I look at them just because I like to see what they're going to do, but they're just a 2-second look and they're done.
Yeah.
TV, you don't have any competition. It's just you. Yeah. What stations do you go on? You try to go on the main ones?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. 8, 4, and 2.
You know, there's a thing at the paper that I would have done if I had to, where they let you put your sticker on the front of a newspaper.
We're doing that also. Yeah.
Yeah, that one I was pretty pleased with. You know, it's funny. I was even thinking about, because I was ramping up, getting ready when this guy stand up, of trying to do a bunch of virtual type meetings online and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part is the way people act and things, it's very hard to.
Yeah.
How do you just open that door for open public conversation when people are just rough? You know, not everybody.
Yeah, they're
not everybody.
You know, people, I think you have to feel some sense of, you know, sorry for people because they are in the middle of a really tough situation for all of us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and,
you have to be
first. Morning.
Morning.
So, you know, I don't think people are happy about being locked up, but at the same time, you know, what's the alternative?
No, it's true. Well, I'm kind of nervous a little bit about some of our renters who have been struggling when they be able to get them finances. Yeah, a lot of them still have unemployment help, but now they're getting ready to start do evictions. I don't understand the timeline of this. So, you know, we shut purpose and then all this keeps walking. No.
Mr. Chair.
Morning.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Morning, Mr. Chair.
How are you? How is everybody?
Good.
Hanging in there. Doing good.
Interesting. We just keep having interesting weekends, do we not?
That word interesting, it's a perfect word because it could mean so many things.
With me, it usually does. Sorry for the casual attire today, but I am going to be moving the remainder of the day, so.
Oh, you're moving into the new house?
Well, not yet technically, but I'm working on it. Like I got to go pick up flooring today and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You doing your own flooring?
I am having help do my own flooring. How about that?
Yeah.
But I got to go pick it up. I bought it from this place down in Sparks off of Glendale called Pro Source Flooring. Mm-hmm. It's awesome down there. They do a great job.
Oh, that's cool.
But
I'll tell you.
The only problem is I got to go pick it up and put it on a trailer and deliver it to my house. So.
Fun.
And then the rest of my house is in complete shambles or in a box somewhere. What's up, Oscar?
Check it out.
What's up, team? How you guys doing?
What are you doing, buddy?
You know, living the life.
Hey, Oscar.
Good morning. Good morning.
Are you at your home? You have your own office, or is that your office?
My office is my home, Chris. Come on, man.
Hey, you.
All I do is work, man.
I just see you're showing off that you graduated behind you.
And they give everybody student of the month at some point.
Morning, Ned.
Good morning. I never got student of the month though, Oscar.
Oh man.
That's why he got a Harley, because he
you're a proudful man, man. I didn't mind brown nosing every now and then.
I don't know about that.
You know, I've been studying my Spanish. You know what? I didn't know Delgado meant thin. So look at you. You just follow your name. I'm like, wait a minute. I know a thin Delgado that helped me remember the word. You're helping my Spanish, brother.
That's what Lucy means, too.
Actually, I thought that meant something different. But
it means a lot of different things. Remember that.
Depending on who's saying it.
Lots of alternative meanings.
Good morning, Yoma.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning, good morning.
Here's a toast of tea to you.
Cheers.
Good morning.
Look at that doggy.
Oh, what a cutie. Oh my gosh.
He's just a little bit of a lap dog. Just a little.
Yeah, my dogs are big. That wouldn't work very well.
You what?
Okay, good morning, everybody. It is 9 a.m. This is July 6th. The last meeting that I have as the chair of this wonderful Community Homeless Advisory Board. And so I'd like to call the meeting to order. And who just did that wonderful moving of the flag right in front of that? Let's salute that flag right there. That's a beautiful flag that we'll salute. Thank you, Elizabeth, for doing that so that we can all see the American flag this morning. We appreciate it, especially coming off of the our Independence Day this weekend. So with that, please, will you join me in a salute to our flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. Elizabeth, thank you so much for moving that flag so we could all see that, enjoy that this morning. All right, Madam Clerk, can I get a roll call, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Bob Lucy, Chair.
Here.
Marcia Birkbigler.
Here.
Neoma Jardin, Vice Chair.
Here.
Oscar Delgado.
Here.
Christopher Dare.
Here.
Ed Lawson.
Here.
I'm Nancy Carrick, County Clerk, and I believe we have Assistant District Attorney David Watts Fial on Zoom also.
I am here on Zoom.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for joining us this morning. Madam Clerk, was there any public comment submitted via email in regards to this Community Homeless Advisory Board meeting?
I haven't seen any, Mr. Chair.
And do we have anybody joining us via Zoom this morning that would like to submit public comment? If you would, all you would have to do is raise your hand and we will unmute you and allow you to speak at this time. Is there anybody in the waiting room?
No, Chair. No one has raised their hand.
All right. Seeing none, we will close public comment, bring it back to the board. We are on to item 4. This is the approval of minutes of the May 5th, 2020 meeting. Are there any changes any of the board members would like to make to the minutes?
Move approval.
I have a motion from Commissioner Birkbigler. Do you have a second?
Second.
Second from Councilman Dare. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion carries unanimously.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
That was an action item, so we need to take public comment.
Thank you, Bad Dave. Is there any public comment on that?
I have no emails, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We are on to item 5. This is the election of chair and vice chair for the Community Homeless Advisory Board going forward. So with that, I would like to make a motion that we elect Councilwoman Naomi Jardin, who has been active as our vice chair, as the chair.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, motion carries unanimously. Congratulations, Madam Chair. The floor is yours. I will turn the meeting over to you.
Mr. Chair, before you do that, if you could take public comment.
We haven't finished it. We haven't finished, Dave. I will in a minute.
You did have a motion and a second and took a vote, and you need to take public comment before that.
Is there any public comment?
There are no emails, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any in Zoom?
No. No comment on Zoom.
All right. With that, I will turn it over to the new chairwoman. Chairwoman Jardin, the floor is yours, ma'am.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Chair Lucy, for the great work you have done on this board for the last year? Year or two? Is it a year term? I know it's been trying times recently for us to be able to get together and do the important work, but now more than ever, the work that we do on this board can't be overemphasized. The decisions that we make, particularly during these trying times, to protect our most vulnerable, significantly important. So I appreciate your trust in me and your election of me as board. With that, we'll move on to item 6, the board presentation, discussion, and possible action to accept the update on the Built for Zero initiative.
Don't we have to do vice chair?
Yeah, do vice chair.
Oh, my apologies.
Chairwoman, sorry.
Back up.
I turned it over to you mid item.
Okay, on this item, it's the same item, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Bye. At this time, entertain a motion for the vice chair.
I make a motion that we elect Ed Lawson as our vice chair.
I second that.
We have a motion and a second. Madam Clerk, Mr. Clerk, is there any public comment on this item?
No, ma'am.
Thank you. With that, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes unanimously. Congratulations, Mr. Lawson.
Thank you.
Okay, now on to item 6, presentation on Built for Zero, Dana Searcy. I think you might be muted. Dana, can you hear us? I see that she's on. I don't see a face nor a presentation. I would ask those with staff at the county, are we having some technical issues getting her live?
We're checking.
Thank you.
Do you want to launch her presentation?
is going to shows me.
So while we're doing that, I wonder if we want to move, is there's any other items we might be able to get a quick update? Oh, okay, here's.
Madam Chair, we might be able to move on to item 8, which is Dave Watzfield's presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and as we're trying to work out the issues with Dana, maybe we can move on if the board is okay with it to item 8, board presentation by David Watts Vial on the assistant district attorney regarding the Martin versus City of Boise.
All right. Good morning, everyone. As noted, my name is Dave Watts Vial. I'm the assistant district attorney with Washoe County. And a couple of months ago, there was a request to talk about the impacts of the Martin versus Boise decision that came out of the Ninth Circuit last year. The Ninth Circuit last year held that there were two Boise City ordinances. There was a disorderly conduct ordinance and a camping ordinance, and both of which criminalized sleeping outside on public property, and said that those violated the Eighth Amendment because they imposed criminal sanctions against homeless individuals for sleeping outdoors on public property when no alternative shelter was available. The basis of that decision and part of what the court said was it's unconstitutional for the state to punish an involuntary act or condition if it is the unavoidable consequence of one's status or being. And said the state cannot criminalize conduct that is an unavoidable consequence of being homeless. And specifically they said you can't criminalize sitting, lying, or sleeping in the streets. The court seemingly made a very limited decision, and they said as much. And what they said was they made a very narrow holding and said, look, the only thing you can't, here's what the specific language is. So long as there is a greater number of homeless individuals in a jurisdiction than the number of available beds, the jurisdiction cannot prosecute homeless individuals for involuntarily sitting, lying, and sleeping in public. And essentially, to put it another way, as long as there's no option of sleeping indoors, the government can't criminalize people for sleeping outdoors on public property on the premise that they have a choice in the matter. There was a very strong dissent in the case, and they essentially confirmed that holding. And here's how they summarized it. Under the panel's decision, local governments are forbidden from enforcing laws restricting public sleeping and camping unless they provide shelter for every homeless individual within their jurisdiction. So it seems like a relatively simple concept, right? You have to count the number of homeless people, you have to count the number of beds, and as long as there's more beds than there are homeless, then you can go ahead and enforce those laws. But like many things with the law, it gets way more complicated after that. So let's start with the initial premise, counting the homeless. Well, counting the homeless is an inherently difficult activity given the nature of people, and particularly in a place like Reno and Washoe County and Sparks, where people come and go on a regular basis. So the first question becomes, how do you know that your count of the homeless is accurate? This is a very big concern because even the majority who tried, again, who suggested, hey, this is a simple opinion to interpret, here's what they said. It's widely recognized that a one-night point-in-time count will undercount the homeless population, as many homeless individuals may have access to temporary housing on a given night, and as weather conditions may affect the number of volunteers, the number of homeless people staying at shelters. So the dissent pointed out, look, municipalities aren't going to be able to enforce their laws if they can't accurately count the homeless. And as the majority said, it's super difficult to count the homeless. So one of the things that all the municipalities are going to struggle with is when can they enforce their ordinances based on a count of the homeless? How accurate is your homeless count? The second half of that, of the calculation, is how many beds are available? Again, seems like count the beds compared to the homeless, then you have it figured out, but that's not the case. The issue becomes how many beds are actually available. And in the Boise case, they talked about some different circumstances that made those beds not necessarily available. So some of the shelters had a maximum stay time. So somebody could stay for 17 days, and then they had to stay away in any given any single shelter, then they had to stay away for another 30 days. Other shelters had religious requirements. You had to participate in education. Sometimes they had counseling. Some of the shelters had check-in times that resulted in turnaways. So if you didn't check in by 8 p.m., you couldn't get into that shelter. And that essentially is what the court concluded. Said, look, those are people who were turned away. They're still homeless. They still have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to sleep. And essentially they said those beds are not really available. And as long as you have people who have to sleep outside because there's not enough beds available, then it's going to be very difficult to enforce your ordinances. This led to some other issues that I've spotted and taken a look at. And one of them is, you know, what do you do if you have somebody, you've done an accurate census of the homeless, you've counted up the number of beds that are available, and now you're turning somebody away because they're disruptive. They have a history of being disruptive. Well, is that going to be an issue if we get challenged later on? The answer is maybe. A court could find that that's somebody who still doesn't have anywhere to sleep, that they don't have a shelter to go to. And really, at the end of the day, it's going to be if people are being turned away from shelters for almost any reason, that's potentially going to be a basis for a claim. So how does that apply here? There have been some different options that have been suggested, including I'm just calling it an event style tent. It's a very large style tent. And then there was a suggestion, a question of, you know, could you designate areas for people to camp and then potentially enforce the laws? Well, again, you have the Ninth Circuit saying, hey, this is pretty simple. The opinion says we're not outlawing ordinances that bar the obstruction of public rights of way or erection of structures such as tents. Doesn't say that a city has to provide shelter to the homeless or anybody who wants to lie or sleep in the street. But they did say, again, you still have to count the beds and the availability of those beds. And if you're going to designate a place for people to camp, again, you're going to have to go through that math, and that's going to be a complicator. One of the other suggestions was a pop-up tent. Again, Boise and the city of Martin versus Boise doesn't really address that. On its face, it seems like a very good idea. If there's a place for the homeless to go, if it has beds, those are probably going to be beds that are available, but there's going to be some concerns. Again, how many beds versus how many people were homeless that day? Are there any reasons that people could be turned away from using that tent? Unknowns are whether or not a court is going to say that there's minimum staffing or furnishings that need to be in there. Just having a bed is one thing. Do they need to have blankets? Well, one would hope so, but whether or not a court's going to find that dispositive, it could depend on the time of year. Do they have to have restrooms? Is that considered acceptable shelter? Is there storage available for people who come, or is it unavailable? Does that potentially turn people away? And then there's less obvious questions. You know, putting up a tent somewhere is fine and having the beds is fine, but it depends on where it's been located. How easy is it for homeless people to get there? If you have somebody who's just as an example, if somebody's all the way out at Verdi, is it reasonable to expect them to make it into downtown Reno where the shelter's available? So those are some complicators that are in there. Boise also said it was specific to jurisdictions and their ability to enforce laws without an adequate number of beds. So there's another issue that comes up. If the region has X number of beds and the region has X number of homeless, is that sufficient for the city of Sparks to enforce its ordinances, or the city of Reno or Washoe County to enforce its ordinances? We don't know the answer to that. I can't give you the answer. I can for the county. I can at least help guide them on that. Everybody else, those are decisions that each of the individual jurisdictions is going to have to make. And they're going to have to decide whether or not that the regional availability of beds is sufficient for them to go ahead and enforce their individual ordinances. So I tried to come up with some takeaways, things that we're pretty sure about, and then things that we're less sure about, just to try and summarize all of this. One, the accuracy of the homeless count is going to be key. And these are all, again, if you're going to be able to enforce your ordinances, whether you create an ordinance in the future that says, homeless people can, or the homeless have designated camping areas. They can only be in certain areas or whatever. If you're going to do that, the one thing that's going to have to be sure of is how many homeless people are in the area and how's that going to get proved. More beds are better. Obviously, the more beds you have, that's going to take, that'll help with any of the discrepancies you have with counting homeless people. Those are going to need to be counts that are done every day. And then again, the fewer restrictions on the ability to access those shelters is better. If there's hours of availability, when people get turned away because they've come in too late, if there's eligibility criteria, if there's some other restrictions, you know, all of those are going to be potential fodder for a lawsuit later on. Again, less sure, does it matter where the beds are? Again, Reno city limits are different than the city of Sparks, are different than the county of Washoe. Does it matter in relation to where the person who is potentially being cited is? And then again, that goes back to the issue of whether each of the entities can rely upon those, the appropriate number of beds. Again, each of the municipalities is gonna have to figure this out on their own in consultation with their own attorneys. This is my favorite line in any presentation. Everything I've said is not to be designed as legal advice for each of the individual municipalities, which sounds like a giant disclaimer. It's really not. It's just, it's the reality that there's no clear-cut answers on this, and you're going to need to have some in-depth conversations with your attorneys. There's always going to be issues with the number of homeless people. There's always going to be issues with the number of available beds and whether or not you can enforce those ordinances. But I do think, you know, you're, again, the solid areas are, if you're pretty confident in your number of, in the number of homeless people and the number of beds, then that's going to give you a little bit more confidence going forward. So that's the end. Are there any questions that I can answer for anybody?
Thank you very much for that. That was a great summary of that. I'll turn to my fellow members, and if you just raise your hand in your screen, so, and I'll call on you. I'm not really sure how to see the little computerized raised hand, so I'll look to my members. Do you have, anybody have any questions? Council Member Lawson.
I'm trying not to cover my face so you know who it is, although the Harleys give it away. The question is, did they address anything about using some type of an algorithm to determine daily homeless?
There's no mention of algorithm. They don't go that in depth. And one of the big points of dispute in the case, which the dissent pointed out, is it said, look, you're putting your cities and municipalities into a, you know, what's kind of a classic Hobson's choice, which means you're in a little bit of a no-win situation. You're going to have to either make sure you have a ton of beds in relation to the number of homeless people, or you're going to risk a claim. So an algorithm, I guess the answer is it would depend on the accuracy of the algorithm and who's going to prove it up later.
Right. Okay.
David, I guess my question to that would be, could we, I know we do an annual count, and it is a, I would call it a regional count. I mean, this is the regional community homeless advisory board. We do things on a regional basis. And I think we need to approach this with that same regional thought in mind. But I guess my question is this, could we not just use our annual count and pad it by 10% or 20%? And because I too am a little concerned about how we're going to shore up a daily count. I mean, it would that be, I know lawyers answer can be, well, we don't know, but do we not think that an annual count plus a percentage might get us there?
So what you're really getting to are problems of proof. Excuse me. And let me give you a quote from the dissent, because frequently what happens is you'll get an opinion and it's written by the majority of the judges, and then a minority of the judges will say, well, we don't agree. And so you'll end up with 4-3 decisions and things like that. And the dissent will frequently tell you what it is that the majority is saying. And here's pretty much here's the summary of what the dissent said. This holding leaves the cities with a Hobson's choice. They must either undertake an overwhelming financial responsibility to provide housing for or count the number of homeless individuals within their jurisdiction every night, or abandon enforcement of a host of laws regulating public health and safety. So according to the dissent, using the yearly census would not be sufficient.
Well, that's, okay, Member Dale.
So one of the main reasons we were looking at this and wanted to kind of dive into it, and I think you hinted on it, but I just want to kind of clarify. We're wondering, and I don't necessarily believe this is the best answer, obviously the best answer is to find help for as many as we can and see people get in that, but there's people who don't want to step into some of the roads that have been laid out for them. And so giving an opportunity to say, we have a safe camp area, does any of that situation, did you say that does not count? Or that we could give areas like that and give a place? Because, I mean, we don't want people on the river because it's unsafe for our community. So we want to see that changed. So if we put something over, who knows where, I'm just saying in theory, I don't have the answers yet, but we're trying to say, we say you cannot be on the river. If you're going to do this, you have to go there. That's one of the reasons we had this question. And if we have enough piece of property or something like that, would that count? Because they can take their tent or whatever they have over there. I mean, in the future, that might mean there's something provided, but I'm just saying the theory of what we're looking for is it potential. We have to do something about our river. This is not healthy for anybody. Of what we have.
Understood. And I did address it just a little bit. So the opinion doesn't necessarily say that you cannot do that. There is a case out of St. Louis, which is not in the same circuit, so it's not dispositive. It may arguably be persuasive, but it may not carry the day in the Ninth Circuit, that essentially said St. Louis was only criminalizing certain areas where people could not be homeless or couldn't camp or couldn't put up a tent or something like that. But the Boise case doesn't really address that. So in theory, with this case, what its significance is, if you passed an ordinance, if you had or something less formal that said, you can have a homeless camp here or you can have one here, but you cannot have them elsewhere. This case doesn't necessarily address that circumstance. Theoretically, you could, because depending on what the count of homeless beds was versus the number of homeless people that were out there. But it is one of the great unknowns that didn't really get answered in this case. What do you do with people who, I'm using this in quotes, are voluntarily homeless, or they don't want to be, let's not call them voluntary, but maybe they just don't want to go to a shelter for some reason. That's going to be one of the unknowns in this. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for you. It's not really addressed.
Thank you for that. And I do know that counting is always a difficulty, but I also know we've got some great organizations that are, you know, street level that can assist us in that regard, NYEP and RISE and those that are helping this population on a daily basis. And I just wonder if there's, you know, maybe you use the annual count as a basis and then you use some of these other groups that can allow us some augmentation of those counts. Maybe not on a daily basis. I'm not sure how accurate that would be, but in concert with some of those numbers to give us, you know, a more frequent update on what those counts are. And I agree with Member Dare that the need to have a safe camp in concert with a structure for additional bedding, I think it's important. And not only it appears to meet some of the letter of the law of this case for housing, but it also would allow for some flexibility for those that have resistance to going into a larger environment because of PTSD or pets or spouse and those sorts of things. So I do think a blended approach on a facility is really important. And I know we're trying to move in that direction. Any other members have any questions or comments on this item?
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I have a couple questions, just a couple comments. You know, I think when we talk about this, we talk about individuals that are experiencing homelessness, not homeless individuals, because I think when you talk about individuals that are experiencing homelessness, there's so many different stages of that, and a point in time count isn't always accurate because it might be something that occurred for an individual, you know, halfway 6 months post a point in time count. They're, you know, and they can come in and out. And we have many individuals that are service accepting and looking for services and looking for those abilities to find ways forward. I think when we talk about these types of camps and safe camping, they are an option that we should be considering, but they shouldn't be the only option that we're considering. They're part of a larger, more grandiose understanding of how do we approach this so that we are approaching every individual experiencing homelessness. And with that, I think that we've made some great strides with Our Place. We've made some great strides with the Overflow Shelter and with also the CAC. I think there's a number of things we can continue to do and look at this. But from what the deputy district attorney points out, we're going to have to look at this from each municipality and address this in a more consolidated way, so to speak, so that everybody is getting addressed going forward. But I can't just say that this is going to be the end-all, be-all solution. You know, just getting the governor's bowl and making that, I think we need to continue to focus towards the larger focus, which is addressing the problem from a whole, from a holistic standpoint.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Member Birkbigler and then Member Dare.
You know, I can't see how we could ever have an accurate count, even though we have people who are out there and there's no question that they're doing great things. But I mean, on any given day of the week, who knows? And how would you know? I mean, I just don't see that we can get the counts accurate. And so I'm a little concerned about the overall picture of financial capability for the three entities. I don't know where we get the money to make sure that we have enough beds. I think we can assume right now and be fairly accurate that we don't have anywhere near enough beds right now. And, you know, it looks to me like we may be in a situation where we can't even comply with this ruling. And so what do we do to kind of figure out ways around it? One thing I think is really important, and I've been talking with our chair and our county manager about funding the Affordable Housing Trust Fund so that we can get that project up and running, because it would allow for some affordable houses to be built, which will pull some of the people out of the homeless area, although it's certainly not going to address everybody, but it will pull some of the people out. But I think we're going to have to think outside of the box, because I don't see how we resolve this problem. Even if we have enough beds, if we set up a tent, and I know that there's been some talk about that, and I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I know that you guys at Reno have talked about the governor's bowl and possibly, you know, putting tents in there. And I don't have an issue with that. I think that's a fine and dandy idea, but what are you going to do about the people who don't want to go there, or who can't take their dog there, or who can't, you know, share the space with whoever it is they want to share space with? I just think there's so many facets to this that we're going to have to really start thinking outside of the box and working with some of our teams out there who handle these people all the time. It is a grave concern. There's no question. I do agree with you on that, Madam Chair, that this is a grave concern. We really have to do something.
And Member Birkbigler, before we go to Member Dare, I completely agree with that. And I just wonder if in our presentation from Built for Zero, you know, we engaged that group, and part of their charge, as I recall, was to assist in this regard. So maybe there's some light that they will shine on how they can work with, you know, the ambassadors and RISE and NYEP and the shelters to help us in accumulating the counts. And I think the courts, absent some black and white definition, look to those that attempt to meet the gray. And as long as I think we are attempting in every resource we have available to get an accurate headcount, I won't ever profess to know what the courts will always do, but if we're trying our best, I would imagine they would take that into consideration, absent some clear definition of what a count, you know, a count really in their estimation meant. So I think maybe the Built for Zero is going to maybe shine a little light, maybe help us in this regard. Member Dare.
Yeah, I just want to point out too the urgency, and every step we take, we're obviously in a very strange season with what happened with COVID and all of these things. Well, we're about a month to start seeing evictions happen in a way that I don't know that I hope I'm wrong, but it definitely brings some deep concern for me with some new families and new people that have had a place to stay and this whole thing happened. And so it puts a new urgency for us. I mean, there's nobody else going to get this done. And I can tell you, I don't know how to get this done. And I really don't love camps. I mean, to anybody's listening, this is not the best goal, but it seems the best of an answer, that better than anything else we have right now. And so, because we have to do both, we have to be able to have a place for people who have this need, and we can continue to run down that road. But in the meantime, we can't just sit and watch our water be polluted and the different things that happen with that. And so the emergence, there's truly a huge concern. Now, I am wondering if there's any COVID money that could be helpful, because it is a direct result of some of these COVID things. And I don't know the answer to that, but I wonder if there's anything there. But I just can, right now, the issue we have is huge. Without even COVID happening, we've already been having problems. But this next wave, I'm have a lot more concern for.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Member Lawson.
Yeah, I've been saying this for a couple of years. We keep addressing the elephant and forgetting about we got to eat them a little bit at a time. So I think we got to pick some areas we can have success in, like veterans and with the youth, and put our efforts towards that. I understand the beds and everything, that this is a near to impossible thing to enforce. There's no way without some kind of great mathematician that could figure out that X amount of people that get a meal each day translates into X amount of homeless for the region. I don't even know if that's possible. So I think, in my estimation, I'll beg for forgiveness, but we need to do something regardless what it is. And I think we got to find that low hanging fruit right away and get on it, make it happen. And then we'll beg for forgiveness on the other stuff, because you're not going to address this all at once. It's got to be done in little bits and pieces, and it's got to be done over time, and it's going to take time. It's not going to happen. It didn't happen overnight. It's going to take decades to get this problem under control and make something happen. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Thank you very much. And I'll just kind of, maybe we can start to wrap this up. I agree. This issue is complex. The issues of COVID have only magnified the issues surrounding homelessness. And now I suspect a wave of evictions is going to make it even more significant. And the need for us to come up, and I completely agree with Member Lawson, that inaction is not an option. And we may not get to perfect per the gray area of the law, but we damn sure better try our best to get some options for these individuals in our community. And for the record, blankets and bathrooms have to be an amenity, whatever the shelter is. That's a given. So any other members have any questions or comments on this item before we move on? Okay, seeing none, I would move to Madam Clerk. Do we have any public comment on this item?
We do not, Madam Chair, and it's not styled for action.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, we will close this item and we will move back to item
six.
Yes, move back to item six. I think, Dana, I see you online.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear you.
Wonderful. Okay. So I'm just pulling this up. And can you see our presentation this morning?
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I apologize for the technical difficulties, but I think that actually turned out pretty well, because to all of your points, a lot of the questions that you're posing based on David Watzfiel's presentation, Bill for Zero seeks to answer. So I'll go through our presentation, and then maybe we can talk about how that connects to a lot of the topics and the questions that you were just talking about. So as I said, my name is Dana Searcy. I work in the manager's office at Washoe County, and I last spoke to you in March at the CHAB board meeting. I work as the community lead for the Built for Zero initiative, which mostly means that I facilitate the conversation. I help bring everybody to the table and make sure that teams are well-rounded so that we have the right subject matter experts in the room, and that all sides have an opportunity to be heard and make sure that their needs are met. I definitely could not do this without a tremendously dedicated team. There are many people involved, and the list is growing each week. So the people that you see on the screen are not the only ones who are currently involved, but there are two very distinct groups that have started this process. One is this core team. These representatives are from each of the jurisdictions as well as the VA. This team has been hard at work over the past 2 months through the Built for Zero initiative and initiation phases, and also organizing the work that's ahead of us. This team is now expanding into multiple subcommittees, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next few slides. We also have a regional stakeholders team. I think we can all appreciate that the stakeholders of this project include everyone who lives here in our community, but this list that you see, they are dedicated and supported to this initiative, and they are receiving monthly updates, as is this board. Since I last updated you at the March CHAB, for all of us, obviously, things have changed quite a bit. Our trip to the Built for Zero initiation in April was canceled, and our work was delayed as a result of our community response to COVID incidents. In late April, although there was still much work to be done, our the team believed that plans and teams were in place enough that would allow us to focus some time planning for the future. To move forward, we had to be creative. The regional core team attended a virtual Built for Zero orientation. We learned about the process, the methods, and the tools. There are key differences in Built for Zero communities that are experiencing success. And as you mentioned again in this previous agenda item, they all revolve around working together as a community. An integrated command team, this is your regional core team with all of the jurisdictions being available. Community level measurement, focused not on the success of a single program, but on our system as a whole. Comprehensive real-time by name data. This is your list that you're looking for. How do we count individuals in real time that are experiencing homelessness? What are their needs? How can we help them? And what different categories can they fit into that we can provide the correct support? Yes.
Question, is there any way that you can make this full screen? It's so tiny, it's difficult to see it. There you go. Yeah, now you've only got the front. There you go, that's a little better.
I don't think I'm seeing what you guys are seeing.
Seeing a Washoe County Blacks, I just saw my name. You had it just a second ago. It was initially just really tiny, and then you expanded it, and it was, there you go.
Are you seeing the entire screen should be?
Yeah, I'm seeing the how do Built for Zero communities work differently. There, perfect, you've got it full screen.
Interesting, okay. Mine is not showing the same, so I apologize. Okay, and then the fourth one on this is strategic data-driven housing investments. And this really is, you know, we must work together and utilize our valuable and limited resources efficiently. Where are those housing gaps? Where can we bring in programs that can help us address our concerns? Single programs, no matter how successful, do not bring the numbers to zero. Entire communities do. And this is really the core message from Built for Zero. So work we've completed. To date, we have completed a virtual orientation. We have also completed an initial community inventory. This includes an outreach inventory, all of the outreach services in our region and who's providing them, a provider inventory, and also the by name list scorecard. We'll talk about that a little bit more on the next slide. And then also we have, based on all of this information, drafted an action plan. The action plan will be filled out completely by all of the subcommittees in very specific targeted areas that are set up. And then that action plan will be ready to share with our community. So this is a copy of the by name list scorecard, and I'm not going to go over this in detail, but we wanted to include in this presentation the actual questions that Built for Zero asks us to look at in analyzing whether we have an accurate, you know, quality data is what they recommend, or refer to it as a quality data by name list, which means that we have a system set up that we are tracking individuals experiencing homelessness and their needs in real time. And maybe to your point, it can't be accurate each and every day, but really on a weekly or a monthly basis, we're getting as close as we can. And it's a centralized, everybody working in one system and functioning the same way. Everybody, the information goes in the same way. We process information the same way. We determine how people could receive services or how they're willing to receive services, all in the same way. So we as a community are working in unison. And this screen shows the initial assessment results. So again, we don't need to go over this in detail, but this is us, this is our community in relation to 30 different communities all listed across the top. Again, it's very small. I know that you can't see it. It really is just a comparison. A perfect score is 28 questions that you are able to answer yes to. And we are able to answer yes to 11 of them. And the idea is that once you're able to answer yes to all 28 questions that Built for Zero asks you of this by name list, that means that your list should be working in a pretty efficient manner, and you can expect that your data is, again, pretty accurate as to who is experiencing homelessness today and what their needs are. Our community is in need of a regional approach to address homelessness, one that considers all needs, stakeholders, and partners. We should not kid ourselves. Built for Zero is not a guaranteed solution. It's going to take a lot of dedication from our staff to come together to navigate difficult conversations and to build consensus and create buy-in with our community so we can work towards this common goal. What Built for Zero can do for us is serve as our guide along the way. Built for Zero can serve as a regional collaboration platform to help facilitate conversation and align efforts and strategies. Our coaches are committed to being flexible to address both the long-term planning, which is the basic Built for Zero structure, and also immediate needs as they come up. I like to think of Built for Zero as a comprehensive think tank for ideas and possible solutions. So our next steps, there are two tracks that we're going to take. Track A is really the traditional Built for Zero plan. It's really based on gathering, again, efficient and quality data so that you can determine what steps we need to take in real time and not just rely on that once a year point in time count. And then track two is more of a flexible and supportive approach to what is what we're facing today. You know, what's out there that we're talking about. We're talking a lot about safe camps right now. This is a good place for Built for Zero to come in and bring information about what's working in other communities or things that other communities have learned. And so we can put together a good plan for if this is an appropriate thing for our community and how to bring it forward and make it successful. As an example. So under this action plan, there are areas of focus. There are five areas listed there. And each of those areas will have a subcommittee. The subcommittees would be made up or are made up of various providers and partners across our region based on their expertise. Let me know if you come across anyone or if you know of any staff that should be on these teams. They are starting to work. There are two groups in particular that have already started. One of them is the by name list and the other is the outreach coordination, as these are the fundamental steps in the process. I would add that most of these people, you know, these staff work in this every day, and it isn't something that they're not already doing. It's just really bringing them to the table and trying to put some procedures in place again so that we're all looking at data and working in the same manner. This community inventory and dashboard. So one thing that specific to our community we wanted to do was to take that provider inventory that Built for Zero asked for, which is really based on, again, that one point in time count of how many beds are out there in your community and who are the service providers. And we want to take it to the next level. We're going to be reaching out to each of these service providers to get a very accurate inventory of how many beds we have at the emergency level and the transitional level and the permanent supportive housing level and so on, so that we can have an accurate assessment of how many beds we have in our community and, you know, where the holes may be. Then the last item on this list is really the regional homeless solutions matrix. One of the most significant pieces of feedback that I've received is that we have a lot of good ideas in our community, and that the biggest problem is that we're all moving in our own direction instead of one unified direction. I would like to propose taking an organized look at these ideas and efforts and collaborating on them. We are proposing to come up with one centralized document that would serve as a centralized place as a summary for the work that is happening and the ideas that we are evaluating, who's working on them, and how we prioritize them. Again, to points made in the previous agenda item, it is a really large elephant. And if we can't take a direction in a step forward in one direction, we're never going to get anywhere. So as you can see, there's a lot of work and we need your help. We need your help to please support staff in their Built for Zero efforts. Also, as previously mentioned, this is going to take time. We know that time is a precious resource and that this work will undoubtedly require many months to be successful. Your continued support of staff to spend energy and focus on this project is vital. I think a core member of our team summed it up best when she said that We hope that the momentum comes behind the Built for Zero effort so that it isn't just another exercise that we did one summer. And we need you to help us support database decision-making. Resources are always less than what we need, and now more than ever, we need to invest those resources in the most effective way possible. And also provide input and direction for a regional homeless solutions matrix. There's always another idea, a program, or direction that we could take, but in order to make meaningful community-wide progress, our best option is to thoughtfully and purposely choose to focus and all move together in the same direction. And finally, I would just like to add, Built for Zero means a lot of different things to many different people, but for most of the people who I've talked to around the community about Built for Zero, it really symbolizes hope. It's a framework that is grabbing hold across our country, and if we can implement the progress that they've had here, we can too also see progress. And I won't get sentimental every single time that we give an update. But I do believe that it's important for you to know that I'm proud to lead this team. It is not my background in this area, but I feel that over the past several months, I've learned a lot about this topic, our community, and how to be able to help. It's not easy to rise to a higher level and to start a fresh conversation. And I'm proud of this team for rising up with me. And I'm grateful for the opportunity and to those who've reached out to enlighten me or to offer their support. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dana. That was a very good presentation, and I appreciate your passion and your emotion and dedication to this issue. The biggest changes and the best changes generally come from those who have their heart in something, and it sounds like you do. So thank you very much for your work on this. Members that have questions, raise your hand and we'll jump into questions. Do members have any questions on this item? Member Dare.
I want to say one of the big pushes that we have been asking for, so I love that this is a piece of this, has to do with just the layout of this is where we began, here's who's involved, here's where it's going, and I think that was a big part of your conversation is laying all that out and that information. So I know that it feels like sometimes we're a broken record asking for things or what is there, but I think we potentially have something in place now that can get us there. And so I would say my question is, how can we help expedite some of these things that you are working on and supportive? Because I'll tell you what, that information is crucial. And even as our lawyer pointed out, it's crucial for us to move forward to have good information so we even could potentially get to a place where we could draw some strong guidelines. So I don't know, how can we help you best?
Sure. Thank you for that question. I think, you know, it's important to consider the amount of work. None of it is hard, right? It's details, it's process, but the lift is great to really come up with a list of all service providers. What services are they providing? What beds do they have and who could take those beds? You know, as far as also how many people are out there experiencing homelessness, every single one of them by name, by need. Again, it isn't hard, it's a huge lift, and everybody on the team is already, you know, facing a situation where they have a full-time job, and now COVID has come on top of that job, which adds to it. And just like everybody in our community, we're all experiencing this. There's just limited time for that resource. So, you know, in each of our jurisdictions, if we can all find an extra staff member that has time to make some phone calls and to analyze some data, I mean, again, nothing is complicated, but that's really where we are. I think we're going to solidify these subcommittees, come up with this action plan, and then go back to our individual jurisdictions and ask for help. So just maybe supporting that ask is a good place to start. One thing that you guys can expect from all that work is that we'd like to come back to build to CHAB every month or every other month, and we'd like to share with you the action plan, where we are on it, as well as what Built for Zero refers to as the community dashboard, which really is a monthly look at how our numbers are doing, how many people are out there experiencing, how many people have we placed, and again, where pinch points may be and that kind of thing. So there's two areas.
I would request probably every month right now, we'd like to be, I don't want this in my mind to disappear at all. But I think I also want to know, do you have any timeline of goals that you're setting on this? Because this, again, I know that we're in a place where we're moving forward now with a plan, but this is one of those things that we've needed from the beginning of when we first formed this group a couple of years ago. And it's really great that there's some people in place that are going to get this done. But anyway, is there any timeline for that?
Absolutely. Each item on the action plan, so there are five focus areas that are identified. And as we mentioned, right now, the two that are moving are the outreach and the by name list. So that is, you know, one, let's get a list of everyone experiencing homelessness and what the need is so that we have a count and we know, you know, who's out there. And two, the outreach is, they're working really hard right now between law enforcement and between the outreach providers, the ambassadors, all of those teams, you know, where are the hotspots? The goal of that is to identify, you know, let's have a regional map that we know where hotspots are. We know where outreach teams, which team is going where and when, and, you know, when do we call in for additional help? And if a cleanup is thought to be needed, you know, what is the process for that? So those two, it's a fun conversation because all of us on the team want to have results quickly, right? We're all like, hey, 2 weeks from now, we want a full set of policies. And then we realize that that isn't reality. That's not how fast we can work. So when I come back to you, we will share with you the action plan, and we are writing down deadlines for every single item that's on there. We would like to have both the action plan completed and also this community dashboard, which provides a snapshot of the data that we're collecting every month. Both of those by early fall. Hopefully September 1st is the goal for those.
Dana, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, going to Member Lucy, and then I think Member Delgado might have a question as well. Okay.
You know, and I want to just kind of dovetail off of what Member Dare said. You know, he asked, what can we do? And I think right now, when we talk about low-hanging fruit and what we can do, we need to talk about this. These programs cost money. These programs need financial backing to get off the ground. And I want to bring back to the forefront, collectively here in Washoe County, we received $86.7 million, $49 million to the city of Reno, $20 million to the city of county, and then $19 million to Sparks. And so if we're going to collectively talk about these solutions and have these plans, we've now got to put the money behind and utilize those CARE dollars. And those CARE dollars can be utilized for programs like this to move forward, to address issues within the community that have direct relation to protecting the individuals from coronavirus and different things like that. There are ways to utilize these dollars specifically for programs like this.
Thank you, Member Lucy. He is absolutely correct on that. If there's a potential silver lining, excuse me, of COVID, is we might be able to do some things we've not been able to in the past. Member Delgado.
Yeah, thank you to my colleagues. Great questions, supporting where you guys are coming from, especially with respect to timeframes. Quick question on the teams. Dana, I don't see the state of Nevada involved. I think often we think of just the Truckee Meadows as regional partners, and we forget that a lot of these authorities and funds come from the state. Is there any way to get them more involved, or have they been, have we reached out to them, Health and Human Services Department and so forth, so we have a representative there as part of the conversation?
I think absolutely. To this point, it's really been a lot of administrative work, a lot of just data collecting and that kind of thing, but I think you make an excellent point, and since these subcommittees are now being formed, we can reach out to them. I will reach out to them, and we'll get a couple of their team members involved where their expertise is too. I think that's great.
Yeah, wouldn't Richard Whitley from the state be a great opportunity for us to speak with him about that?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And Dana, I know there is a large list of people that you're communicating with. And with regards to the community groups, just on the record, can you tell me who you're speaking with from those community groups that will be assisting us in all these issues, the peer issues that they speak with on a daily basis? I sometimes feel like these boards and these groups that we form and discuss are absent the most important factor, which is the homeless. And we don't often hear their direct voice and their direct experiences and where their barriers are and what their input is. And I think the best conduit to that is some of these community groups that are interfacing with them on a daily basis. So can you tell me who from the community groups you're working with?
Sure. You know, I apologize. I do not have a complete list, but we will generate one. I feel like there right now, for example, our outreach group is meeting twice a week almost. And every time we meet, two or three more people have been joining in. I can share with you, you know, I have up here a real quick list. We've got the Downtown Partnership, RISE, Foundation for Recovery, the Washoe County MOST team. Let's see, the VA, VOA Restart, the Reno Police, the Sheriff's Office, Sparks Police, and then also Eddie House has just joined. All of those groups were large groups that we knew had outreach teams in our community or were involved with outreach services in some capacity. We've been reaching out. We've been asking for members. There's two or three people from each of those groups that are serving on this one subcommittee. And again, it's growing quickly. So we'll work in each of these areas to gather those lists of individuals, and we'll provide them to you guys. We also are we're going to work on having a website up for all this information, because we'd like to share, like I said, the action plan and our community dashboard and all the information that's generating our community scorecard. That really is information that we would like everybody to have access to whenever they'd like to see it. So we will work on all of that.
Thank you very much. And a couple of that just jump out to me. Catholic Charities, yeah. State of Nevada, which member Delgado just mentioned, and there was one, Action. I think Action might.
Yes, but yes, they are involved also.
Okay, good. And I know that list will likely expand. And do you have an ETA on the website? I think that is critical. Like the information we shared today on this meeting, it was small and hard to see, but I know we got some, it's not your fault. But having that on a website that we can push out for the community, we've often said that this group and the entities do a lot of work on these issues, but there's a lot of it that's not known. And I think we need to do a better job of communicating the eating of the, Member Lawson puts it, the little things that we are doing in attempt to make a bigger global impact, and pushing that out in a way that's easily digestible to the community on the whole, I think is a critical component for this to be successful and for the community to, you know, and the complexities of it. It's not an easy thing, and it's not going to be solved by one thing. Member Lawson.
Yeah, Dana, when you are talking about your action plan, can we include who's going to be responsible, what the time frame is, and what are we going to consider as a success? Because we need to celebrate the successes big time. So that all this work that I know you guys are doing behind the scenes, it just seems to me it's so spread out at this point. Bringing it all together, it will make it a lot easier, and then we can actually make some progress towards something. But I think those three things are really important as to who's responsible, time frame, and what do we consider a success?
Thank you. Member Delgado, did you have another question? No.
Thanks.
Any other members have any additional questions on this item? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Dana, and I'll bring this up under member items, but if you just check your calendar for July the 20th, I'll be asking for a special meeting for that date. Okay, Madam Clerk, do we have any public comment on this item? Yes.
No, ma'am.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
we do.
Yes.
Oh, we do. Okay.
You do. It's your county manager, Eric Brown.
Welcome.
Are you staff or are you public comment?
I am staff.
Oh, okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah, then I'm retiring.
I'm still permitted.
Yes,
you are permitted.
So good morning, everybody. I just want to thank Dana for a great presentation. She has done a yeoman's job jumping in, pulling this together. You can all imagine across the jurisdictions and all the nonprofit organizations involved, and given the COVID-19 demands on everybody's time, this is really impressive to see where we are. I would just remind the CHAB committee a couple of things. One is the discussion you were having prior to Dana's presentation about getting our arms around our homeless population. This is one way that we can approach that. And I've seen, just prior to COVID hitting, I was back in Washington with Chair Lucy and Commissioner Hartung and Commissioner Herman, and I had a chance to meet with the folks from HUD in DC. I asked them about Built for Zero. They recognize it as sort of a seal of approval, if you will, that a community is serious about addressing its homeless issues and is taking a coordinated approach to doing so. So notwithstanding the comments of Mr. Watts Vial about the Boise decision, I would offer to you that although nothing can ensure totally that a judge somewhere wouldn't take an adverse judgment against us, you all know that, being a Built for Zero community goes a long way towards ensuring that there is some standard that we've gone through to try to document what our homeless population is real time. That's part of what this does. So that's one. Two is I don't know if anybody from EDON is on, but I would remind this committee that since I got here in November, one of the things the business community made clear to me is, Eric, if we could just get a coordinated effort in this region around the homelessness problem, the business community would step up and offer resources, money, whatever, if we knew what our role was in the grand scheme of the plan. So this action plan that Built for Zero is working on, I think is the key to identifying how do we get the right resources aside from our jurisdictional governments, from other entities in the community to help address this problem. So I just want to point that out because it, not only is it the work that we're doing, but it also opens us up to additional funding sources, which is part of what many of the Built for Zero communities have seen as they move forward. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Manager Brown. Thank you very much for those comments. And you are absolutely right that there are other groups and organizations that are have expressed a willingness to help us in this regard once they understand what the goal or the plan is in order to help us get to that goal. So I think the more expeditious we can be in putting that roadmap together, the quicker we can fiscally get those funds that I've heard from a number of sources to help us achieve that goal. So thank you all very much. And Manager Brown, thank you for your leadership on this issue as the lead agency for a lot of these, for really all of these issues. I appreciate your involvement and understand it to be a top priority of yours, and I thank you for that. Okay, Madam Clerk, do we have any other public comment?
I have no emails, Madam Chair.
No, sir. Thank you very much. Okay, moving on from that, we are on item 7, board presentation on current projects, Our Place, and regional planning for homelessness by RISE. Ben Castro, you're up.
Good morning. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Fantastic. I hope everybody had a safe and happy holiday weekend. Real quick, I just want to thank Ms. Searcy and Mr. Watts for their presentations. Very informative, fascinating dialogue. Yeah, we have a lot of work ahead of us. So I appreciate those conversations. A couple of things real quick. If anybody's ever worked with RISE before, they know that we usually come as a group. If I can ask that Lisa Lee and Kim Barghouti be given the ability to unmute because they're going to present with me or co-present this this PowerPoint with me.
Ben, who was the second one after Lisa Lee?
Her name is Kim Barghouti.
They're both panelists, so they can share screens and speak.
Fantastic, thank you. And I will go ahead and share my screen.
Great.
Okay. Awesome, thank you. I'll have to apologize for the date there. I didn't get a chance to update it to the 6th. But in any case, we're going to talk about our current projects that RISE is involved in, Our Place, and some regional planning moving forward. So here's a quick presentation outline just for review later. This PowerPoint should have been presented in the public record as well, so you have the opportunity to take a look back. I'm not going to read it to you. So the history and philosophy of RISE. We were founded right here in Reno, Nevada. About 8 years ago. At the time, it was actually in my apartment. We've had some significant upgrades since then. But the idea was pretty simple. We have hungry people in our community, and we had food to share. Our pilot project was the Rise and Dine project, where we invited our neighbors to cook their family's favorite meal and join us and serve it to people who are hungry. As the years went by, I've had the great privilege and honor of meeting, in my opinion, some of the greatest people in this community on both sides of the table, those who came to serve and those who came looking for services. Throughout the years, I was even luckier to have a lot of those folks join our team and bring their experience and their perspective and their passion to help define and focus our vision and our goals as we move forward. Even though, you know, I truly believe that this is really one of the greatest communities here in Nevada and in the country. But some of the biggest contributions from our community have come from our unsheltered neighbors. I mean, they're the ones that know the systems, they know what works, they know what doesn't work, they know what's missing, they know what's redundant. And they're the ones that really give us the expertise that have brought us as far as we have today. I mean, I studied finance and economics, and I have a little more than a decade of HR experience. On paper, I have no business being here. What brought us here is that we listen to the people that we're trying to serve, and we believe their stories, and we walk with them, and we take them seriously, and they're the ones that they're really the true experts on what exists out there and the challenges that they face. On that note, our greatest resource is and always has been the people we serve. So at this time, I would like to introduce our Director of Operations, Kim Barghouti. She's going to give a brief update on the current RISE projects.
Good morning. This is Kim Barghouti for the record. In addition to Our Place, which is quite a project all on its own, RISE is involved in four main areas in addition to the dinner service. The living room project provides housing vouchers for people who can't be served by other existing programs, those people who fall through the cracks. In the past 4 years, RISE has paid out over $76,000 to local landlords. The free market program is designed to promote mutual aid. We distribute things that people have given us to people in need. We give out hygiene items, clothing, food. You know, we do this during direct outreach and by partnering with other nonprofits. Our outreach program is vital to understanding the needs of the unsheltered neighbors. Our outreach director goes out to camps and distributes information as well as goods and referrals, references to services. We anticipate that this will increase, you know, we anticipate that the population who are unsheltered will increase with the foreclosures. And so outreach is going to be much more important. At this time, the outreach team also gathers information data on the people entering into Good Grid, which is the system the county is using, and to help to get some good data on the people and give them references, referrals to services that they might find useful. At RISE is our advocacy and training effort. RISE tries to be present at any public meeting where there are issues that impact people experiencing homelessness or poverty are being discussed. And our job as advocates is to look at those public policies and work for change where we see that it might be necessary. The training issue piece of it is we give training for both for people living outside, for the public. We've given volunteer training. We've given de-escalation training. We gave training to the people who staffed the winter tent. And we also train in job skills and substance use resources. Next slide, please. So RISE continues to serve meals through the RISE and Dine program. This program draws more than 700 community volunteers a year. In addition, RISE also coordinates and assists a dozen other volunteer groups who serve meals 7 days a week. Meal service was moved to the East 4th Street location in November of last year. Both cities and the county were instrumental in the change, and they continue to support the new site. Meal operations were moved because we were told that our presence at the CAC was causing a high number of emergency service calls to the campus. The move has meant that some of our neighbors living outside have had a harder time accessing meals. We went from serving 400 people per meal to serving around 100 with no real confidence that the other 300 have access to meals. The meal site has become a place where a sense of community is being built. We were donated a Christmas tree by the Rotary Club in the holiday season, among other things. It provides just a sense of community. The providers have chosen the name East 4th Rest Stop for the new location because naming it makes it seem more personal and less clinical. And we're happy to report that in the 8 months we have been at the rest stop, we're aware of zero emergency calls for security reasons. The rest stop was serving about 1,000 meals per week prior to the pandemic. It dipped some during the quarantine, but we are preparing for a spike. As some of the members mentioned, you know, when the evictions kick in, we anticipate that there will be a lot more need. So we are working to get our information out there to the populations that might be impacted. And also not to mention the high level of unemployment that we're facing. So I think that we're certainly going to have the need there. We do still have need for a couple of community groups who can provide meals once or twice a month. If anyone knows of a group, your congregation, your family, your social club that's interested in doing that, if they can contact me directly, I would certainly be happy to hear from them. For the next slide, I will yield to Jen Cassidy, who's the shelter director at Our Place.
Thank you, Kim. Good morning, and thank you all for your time. I'm Jennifer Cassidy, director of Our Place. The people are what make RISE great. At RISE, we understand that diversity makes us stronger. Having a wide range of lived experiences at the table offers us perspective, strength, creativity, and accountability. Our board of directors range in age from Gen Z to boomers. We represent education levels from GED to PhD. We have an incredible number of years of community involvement and a vast variety of life and work experiences. And as you can see, something we're incredibly proud of, we have over 160 years of combined personal recovery. Next slide, please. Ben is a fan of saying that at RISE, we don't take our titles very seriously, and that is certainly true. We believe, and we show through community successes over the last several years, that organizations run best when they are collaborative and as consensus-based as possible. Working without much hierarchy requires a great deal of communication, can include chaotic moments and intense conversations, takes time and care, and it's absolutely worth it. While we don't take our titles seriously, we do understand the importance of our work and our roles. Over the last 2 months, we've put together, well, 3 months now, we've put together a team that is compassionate, mission-driven, and diverse. The Our Place team consists of a powerful group of people with a rainbow of lived experiences. Next slide, please. Our hiring process included prioritizing peers and making sure that they have the power to guide services, as well as the support to do so safely. Through recognizing the value of lived experience, we remain a team of individuals who walk alongside our clients. Our model is collaborative and intentional. We understand the value in each task we do, whether scrubbing tables or sitting quietly with someone. Data has shown that we need to add resources into our community that look different than current models. Our approach understands the value of relationships, respect, dignity, trust, and mutual aid. And supported, equipped peers can ease the tyranny of the moment that so many of our neighbors are experiencing through the wealth of knowledge that comes from shared experiences. Next slide, please. Building relationships based in trust and accountability is one of RISE's specialties. We're working to create therapeutic home environments rather than just a spot to lay heads. Our model is structured to feel like a respite, a spot to heal before the next step. At RISE, we've witnessed that strong relationships lead to smoother transitions that allow clients to build the social capital needed to thrive and to give back to our community in meaningful ways. Our staff understands the importance of listening first, utilizing motivational interviewing, and supporting clients in navigating barriers. Historically, with this person-first approach, our clients are quickly transitioned into more sustainable living situations. We are compassion-driven and outcome-based with a focus on long-term housing solutions that fit the needs of individuals. We recognize that diversity makes us stronger and embrace human uniqueness. Rather than seeking to build a program that pushes people to adapt, we collaborate to build responsive interventions. Next slide, please. As welcoming and supportive as we're working to make Our Place, we at RISE know that the entire needs of the community will not be met by this one solution, and we continue to work on many fronts to provide a kaleidoscope of solutions. It is important to note, however, that housing that people can afford is the solution to homelessness, and that the solutions that we are presenting today are presented to add to the community rather than to be utilized to enforce oppressive laws that criminalize poverty and homelessness. Next slide, please. Next, we will have Lisa Lee from our board of directors to discuss the necessity and efficacy of a Safe Camp Collective.
Thank you, Jen, and good morning, everyone. Lisa Lee for the record. I'm actually off the board of directors and the new peer director at RISE. And I'm here this morning to discuss our Safe Camp initiative. Next slide, please. We realize that community leaders are tasked with balancing multiple competing demands from a diverse array of stakeholders. And I just want to take a moment to thank all of you for your service. These conversations are difficult, and we appreciate you leaning in to balance the diverse needs of businesses, public health officials, public safety needs, and all residents in our community, whether housed or unhoused. Next slide, please. Homelessness in our region has grown over the years, and there are so many new faces out there. We know that the thing, as Jen mentioned, that solves homelessness for those who want to end their homelessness is housing. Our numbers reflect a solvable amount of individuals. If we had the housing inventory, we could meet the needs of our community. Although we have a shelter system, there are relevant barriers that continue to screen out rather than screen in, and they still fail to meet many complex individual needs. We cannot rely on a one-size-fits-all model. We all know that homelessness compounds other concerns, such as mental health, physical health, and substance use, and all too often results in untimely and unnecessary deaths and injuries. Next slide, please. Participatory strategies are those that include people and invite them as resources rather than recipients. In 2017, I designed and implemented a survey on the river that asked people open-ended questions. We are continuing this survey now in Google Forms for ease of implementation with the Outreach Subcommittee for Built for Zero. These are some of those narratives that emerged from the 2017 data. This slide asks about daily challenges people experience. The respondents, as you can see, indicate that constant displacement is a common hardship and stressor. Constant evictions also make linking people to services or even counting them a very difficult process. Next slide, please. This slide asks about barriers to staying in the shelter. Many respondents cite similar reasons such as anxiety and feeling overwhelmed by the amount of people in one place. These reasons are similar to what the corpus of literature on the topic indicates. And as you can see, there's kind of a common theme that emerges from these narratives. Next slide, please. Researchers have cited three main reasons that people prefer to remain in encampments rather than going into a shelter. The first is shortcomings in the shelter system, which speaks to different barriers that people encounter. The second theme that emerges is a sense of safety and community within the encampments, which speaks to this idea of social organization and community. The third is a desire for autonomy and privacy, which really speaks to broader cultural frameworks that we have that value autonomy and privacy. A few of the barriers that our friends outside have cited are listed here. They have pets and they will not part from their companion and support system, or they have a partner and they're not, again, going to part from that companion and support system. They have lived outside for many years, and losing autonomy and their gear to sleep inside with hundreds of others is very frightening. And the role that trauma, social anxiety, and previous adverse shelter experiences may be too much. Next slide, please. We realize there are multiple considerations which we would need to address to lift up a successful and safe encampment, many of which are listed here. However, we are confident that we have the talent, compassion, commitment, and grit in our community to thoughtfully and intentionally co-create something great. We can always count on our friends and neighbors to do the heavy lifting with us. Next slide, please. Many cities have adopted policies that sweep people to encourage the utilization of city-operated shelters. However, evidence suggests that this is ineffective to increase shelter usage, and people just move camp to a new location. And we can see this again in our own community as well. This approach is effective at eroding trust and creating adversarial relationships that are often termed as program resistant. There are several variations of sanctioned encampment models that are successful that include the Courtyard in Las Vegas, which is a city-run shelter area where residents sleep in an open-air courtyard. There are safe parking programs, and these screen out sex offenders and recent violent offenders to ensure safety and wrap supportive services around the residents there. There are self-governed encampments with public and private oversight with promising outcomes. And some of those are listed here. If you'd like to do some reading, I encourage you to do so. Data has been collected by the City of Seattle, which found that neighborhood crimes where encampments are located did not increase. And I believe that Eileen and Iris presented on this several months ago as well. They also found that self-governance led to residents building competence and leadership skills. Between September 2015 and May 2017, 759 people were served within six different encampments in the city, and 121 people transitioned to permanent housing. Several city-sanctioned encampments grew actually out of civil disobedience in response to city sweeps, where people were pushed back against constant displacement. Several of these organic camps that ended up being turned into city and sanctioned encampments, or they turned into nonprofits, include Whoville in Eugene, Oregon, which is pictured here. They became the Nightingale Health Sanctuary. There was Operation Homestead, which was a squat back in the 90s in Seattle that ended up becoming Orion Court and developed into the Low Income Housing Institute, or LIHI in Seattle, which operates around 2,000 low-income housing units, as well as several tiny home communities and encampments in the Seattle area. And then Dignity Village in Portland, which began as people came together to protest constant sweeps back in 2000. And they were eventually moved to a city-sanctioned encampment that turned into a tiny home village. It's 20 years old and has been very successful. The theme that unites these encampments is that they were initiated and sustained by marginalized people whose participatory strategies created positive change, empowerment, and built self-efficacy. Next slide, please. We know that inclusivity is paramount to successfully working with people experiencing homelessness. We support the growing peer workforce in Nevada and believe that people from the community served is mutually beneficial in healing. As a peer myself, my mantra is nothing about us without us. Invite people with lived experience to the table to work on solutions. And I thank Neoma for mentioning this in the Built for Zero discussion. This slide says, outreach workers are generally better received when they make low demands, offer something that people in encampments might want or need, and share demographic characteristics or lived experiences with those in encampments. People who stay in encampments may be wary of authority figures and are more likely to welcome outreach workers who do not act or present as such. These same considerations may also apply to sanctioned encampments. So as you can see, relationships are key to success here. Next slide, please. A critical need for sanctioned encampments is a centralized space, which would be used for cooking and showers, also restrooms, laundry, and community building. Garbage service would also be necessary. The social organization would assist in maintaining these features. Social organization of successful encampments include shared decision-making and shared responsibility, making people feel human and connected to purpose as everyone contributes. Participatory rather than paternalistic. I can tell you the first step in reintegration to the broader community is to be treated humanely, to be included and respected. Social organization that empowers residents to create and maintain the rules of community, including sweat equity or compulsory service in the community, and a resident advisory council have been successful for decades. Again, in communities like Dignity Village, Nightingale, and the Share Wheel, multiple encampment communities up in Seattle. The operating principles remain pretty consistent throughout these models. The first would be democratic decision-making, with every member having an equal vote. The second are all residents contribute to the day-to-day operation of the encampment. This includes contributing to camp security, participating in neighborhood service activities, and other operational duties. The third is residents hold each other accountable for individual actions. A grievance procedure is used to resolve conflicts. And the last is residents can be barred from camp for serious violation of the rules. Barred individuals are asked to leave the camp property. Re-entry can be petitioned depending on the severity of the offense. Next slide, please. We have all lost friends and neighbors too soon. Before we discuss the financial impacts of doing the same thing and expecting different results, I would like to ask Jennifer Cassidy to discuss some of the human costs. Jennifer.
Thank you, Lisa. Because we have to, we will be discussing fiscal details. Before we do, though, I must say that the human cost of being inadequately sheltered should be enough. One person that would like to rest under a roof with a door that locks who doesn't have that basic right is one too many. Trauma, lost relationships, stolen dignity, exposure, lost limbs, and lost lives. Well, we don't want to traumatize anyone by adding the picture directly into our presentation. I encourage you to follow this link and witness some of the suffering that inaction and hand-wringing about money cause. Personally, I've lost too many of my neighbors, my community members, and my friends at ridiculously young ages to relate all of their stories here. I am going to relate a summary of the stories of two of my friends who died far too soon. One day, a friend introduced me to a quiet man with a beautiful smile and eyes like a sunny day sky. He was timid, kind, and humble. He was also quite sick, angry, and afraid. My new friend understood how sick he was and that he needed medical care, but healthcare professionals had not always been kind to him, which is unfortunately common when you don't have an address. He couldn't make himself go to the hospital. It took months and constant, exhausting navigation of systemic barriers, each one a blow to his dignity. Eventually, we got a diagnosis. Cancer, not treatable, even for a young man in his 40s. The horror of a terminal diagnosis is exponentially worse when one has no social support, no family, few friends, and no address. We set quickly to work gathering as much as we could. We found a roof, a hospice company willing to take the hit as he had no insurance and likely was not going to live long enough to get any. And we supported his friends so that they could support him. It was far less than ideal, but he died with as much dignity as we could gather. The anger and the sadness over how much work and how much time it took to give this man the bare minimum at the end of his life still makes me sob. Not long after that, I lost another dear friend. I had known him for years. He was hilarious and often had me laughing so hard that tears ran down my cheeks. I much prefer laughing tears to the tears I cried telling his 18-year-old son, who had just graduated high school, that he needed to come say goodbye to his dad, especially since they had just repaired their relationship. This friend's illness came suddenly. He was knocking out goals and making plans. The day I picked him up to take him into a residential treatment facility, I ended up taking him to the emergency room instead. He never made it out of the hospital. The doctors told his mother and his son that his many years spent living outside had just damaged his body too much for him to pull through. None of this should ever have happened. It's long past time for action. We need to change this now. And Lisa will take the next slide.
Thank you so much, Jen. The human costs of homelessness are unimaginable and really should not be happening in this country. As you can see in this slide, and as Jen indicated and many others, it's complicated. There are multiple causes, push factors that push people into homelessness, and just as many solutions to homelessness, that we really do need a continuum of services to make sure that we're helping lift up as many people as possible in our community. Next slide, please. We also realize that policymakers must make decisions based on financial costs to the public. Based on 2018 data, a person experiencing homelessness costs the public around $45,000 per person per year. Please keep in mind that a person who also has comorbid or multimorbid conditions can cost the public up to $250,000 per person per year. Often, crimes linked to a person's housing status can lead to incarceration. Things like unpaid tickets can lead to jail time, which costs over, and this is old data, this is based on 2016 data, costs over $180 just for booking and about $108 a day to be incarcerated at the jail. Substance use treatment is also costly, and so is mental health treatment. Sweeps can cost taxpayers over $4,000 a day in just personnel costs. And this data was derived from personal observations at sweeps by looking up those staff that I saw there in Transparent Nevada and then crunching the numbers to an hourly rate. This doesn't even reflect the heavy equipment, et cetera, or the clean and safe contract, which is, I believe, $250,000 for 6 months. Homelessness costs people years off their life. The average life expectancy of a person experiencing homelessness is 50 years old, 20 years shorter than housed people. The average ranges from about 42 to 50, which means there's a lot of us probably on this meeting today that are, you know, we would be dead. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, people experiencing homelessness have a greater risk of infections, chronic illness, substance use, and mental health disorders. Safe encampments are an essential piece of the housing continuum, and our proposal would cost slightly less than $10 a day per person. We estimate that we could at least serve 150 people a year, given the bottleneck in the housing continuum. Next slide, please. To go over the budget, I'd like to invite Ben Castro again to present our budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa and Jen, honestly, and team for your countless and immeasurable work that you perform, and for years on a volunteer basis. It's the resilience of the people we serve and the compassion that you exhibit is truly inspiring, and it honestly, it motivates me to want to do better. So thank you. In any case, so moving to what we feel is a pretty modest budget. I'm not going to go over every line item. Bottom line figure here you're looking at is about $500,000 for a year to administer a safe camp. We feel it's a very modest proposal, very modest salaries. But more importantly, we feel that we have the right people in place to do this. As Jen had mentioned earlier in our place hiring, we were very intentional with the people we hired to employ people who had lived experience in homelessness or recovery or staying in shelters or why they didn't stay in shelters. The compassion and the motivation of the people we hire, I think, are key because they understand that building those relationships and establishing that trust is really how you get people inside. I tell the Our Place team all the time whenever I get asked about guest issues or personnel issues or how to handle, you know, day-to-day operations. I tell them, be the person that you wanted to be when you were seeking help. Be the person that you needed to speak with when you were looking for help, and handle those situations in that regard. And that's, I think, it's immeasurable having the right people in place. So as far as the budget discussion, again, everybody has a question as far as who's going to pay for it. For us, we're already paying for it. We're paying for it every single year with our overburdened public institutions, the countless hours that we spend trying to find displaced people, from our outreach workers to our caseworkers to law enforcement, and then the countless hours once they are found, spent trying to reestablish that trust and trying to get back on track with recovery, or trying to get back on track with, okay, your ID's been misplaced. Getting an ID is extremely difficult and time consuming. So let alone just the money that we would be saving regionally by giving people a central place to go. We would also be able to have a central data intake point to assist with gathering a truer sense of the need that exists in our community. But more importantly, we can't gloss over the human suffering that we would be saving these people. Throughout my near decade experience in this community and with this community, it's really disheartening to see people, especially when they're fresh outside, and you can tell who they are because they look scared. They look scared. And I'm not trying to perpetuate any sort of negative stereotypes, but they look cleaner. They look like they're fresh outside. And you can see it in their eyes that they feel helpless and they feel hopeless. And in my experience, time outside works a little bit differently for the rest of us. A week outside for somebody can feel like months. Hours can feel like days. And you can run into that same person 2 weeks later and something changed in them because they've become hardened with the environment, with the way that they're treated, and really just the sense of abandonment. But it doesn't mean that doesn't mean that they're that way forever, and it doesn't mean that it has to be that way forever. I always tell people I'm you know, talking with every breath you take is another opportunity to change everything. And the only permanence is death. Until then, you know, we will do everything we can to inspire that light to keep going and to keep fighting. And for this community, you know, the only times that they're members in our community, they're our neighbors. And they get accustomed to being treated as if they're invisible, as if no one sees them. And the only times that they're not invisible is when they're reminded that they're not welcome here. And it's no way to exist, and it's cruel and inhumane, honestly. So This challenge, as we had kind of spoken earlier, is that, or at least this committee has spoken earlier, it wasn't created overnight. It's not going to be solved overnight. We definitely understand that. We also understand that a safe camp initiative is not ideal. Ideally, there would be enough homes for everyone, enough places for people to go. That's just not our reality at the moment. It's going to take all regional stakeholders, all laser focused on pursuing these objectives. And it's going to take multiple prongs too. A safe camp initiative is not going to be for everyone. And we definitely understand that. But it will help quite a few people. It will give some of that public option to where you can be here until we can get you somewhere else. And folks, they're doing it now. I mean, people, again, this community, our unsheltered neighbors, they're some of the most resilient folks I've ever met in my life. And they're finding ways to survive on bare minimum. And instead of spending money to oppress that, to clean up after them, to quote unquote clean up after them, to basically displace them and throw away all their belongings, as opposed to facilitate their growth and their existence, we feel we would have better outcomes that way. So it's going to take all of us to address this situation. So one last thing I want to say, and I say to a lot of people, but throughout the years I've been asked, what does the perfect dinner look like? Because was our flagship operation, the community potluck, the Rise and Dine project. Or what does the perfect free market look like? Or what does the perfect shelter look like? And the answer has been the same, and it's the same for all three of them. They're empty. They're empty because those services aren't needed. But until we arrive at that point as a society and as a community, we'll be here. We will be here breaking bread and sharing warmth for people who need a place to call home. So our contact information is here. If you're interested in learning more or getting more involved, and I thank you for your time. And at this point, I'm happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much. And Jen, Lisa, Kim, thank you for your presentations. That was very good. This is not an item for an action item, but I'll allude again to a meeting that I'm going to call for on July the 20th, where it will be. I would turn to my other members and ask them if they have any questions at this time, and if we could get back the screen that shows everybody.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Commissioner Lucy.
First of all, I want to thank the entire RISE team for all their work and dedication that they have put in to this project. You can see their amount of commitment that these individuals have in their ability to bring together this type of directive with this amount of detail and focus. And I want to bring back one slide that Ben pointed out. And, you know, we sit here today, all of us in this meeting, discussing in the midst of a pandemic that's affecting across our world. But I think one of the things that we should think about in a little bit more of a global perspective is that we've been experiencing a pandemic of homelessness for a lot longer. And we have watched our community spend millions, countless and countless millions of dollars to defend lives against COVID, yet we watch individuals that are suffering from homelessness die all the time and suffer from the mental challenges and the emotional challenges that come with homelessness. And when you see those types of numbers, that savings that communities can have by being proactive and really putting the dollars to the programming that needs to happen, you start to realize, why haven't we been doing this all along? All of a sudden we can stand up a post to test individuals and provide masks and PPE, but yet we can't focus for 10 minutes as collective groups and find out ways to put money to get to build programs for these individuals, whether it's safe camps or whatever. But when you look at the numbers, I mean, those individuals really are suffering a pandemic. They are dying out there. And we're not doing anything aggressively enough, in my opinion. But we have the opportunity to do that with groups such as RISE, with groups such as through Our Place, with the Safe Camp, with the dollars that we have from the COVID pandemic. I think we absolutely, once again, I'm going back to my previous statement, we need to figure out ways to go back to our respective entities with the money that was given to us and find out and solve another pandemic that is drastically affecting our area. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do any other members have any questions or comments at this time? Okay, all right. I'm not seeing any on there. Member Dale.
I just want to say thank you. I tell you it's so important that we get to lay it out and see how this could potentially work. And I know it sounds like we're going to have a better or a chance to actually make a decision on some things. I'm really interested to see what we're allowed to use that COVID money on. So I'm looking forward to that conversation, and I commit that I definitely will take it back to our jurisdiction to find out what it is we can do or cannot do. Obviously there's some guidelines that we have to stick with it. I'd say whether COVID money there or not, obviously this is wisdom in this. And I would even shout out to businesses, because when we talk about saving money, yes, it does save some of the cities, you know, small. We don't have tons of resources to say, well, this will save us this much, but it definitely saves some of our businesses tons of money as well. And so I love the idea that our businesses are involved, as Eric Brown mentioned, Manager Brown. And hopefully as a conglomerate, we could see some of these things move forward. But I really appreciate the information on the campsite. I think that that's going to be real important to us. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I too agree with that. I was glad to see this, finally us getting this presentation from RISE. I think this is something I know that I initiated to get more information on it. And now we've got RISE's proposal and concept and some of the details there. What we're missing is what I had asked for, which was our staff's research as it related to safe camps in other communities and the success and failures of those, and how that looks for us moving forward. And again, I'm going to allude to a July 20 meeting that I'm going to call for to bring that forward. But it would be in concert with this. I think there was some things, the concern one of the gaps that I didn't see in RISE's proposal, maybe it was there and just wasn't expounded on, was when you have severe mental illness within the homeless population, how do we treat those individuals that are very resource intense? And we know there are some barriers in order to get them some of the treatment that they may need, and they can cause all sorts of other issues in any kind of an environment. How are we addressing those individuals? That's a component that we seem to be kind of missing, how that severely mentally ill individuals, how we're addressing those. But I do want to thank RISE for their presentation. I thought it was very well thought out and very detailed. And I too would like to know more about how the COVID dollars relate to not only an infrastructure environment as it relates to homeless services, but how it relates to the personnel support that is needed for the operations during the pandemic and beyond. How are those funds, how can they be used to help us in this environment? So. Do any other members have any questions or comments on this presentation at this time? Okay, seeing none, Madam Clerk, do we have any public comment? I'm not hearing Madam Clerk.
Hi, Madam Chair, this is not an action item and I have no emails.
Okay.
Any public comment.
Thank you very much. Okay, that was not an action item. We will move on now to item 9, board update on efforts to find a location for a longer term shelter location for adult males to provide for adequate social distancing. City of Reno, you're up. I think this might be Arlo. I don't know who's giving this. Monica?
I think it's Soda.
Anybody? Bueller?
I think it's Chief Soto. I know we're looking for it.
I see Arlo is on and he's unmuted, but I'm not hearing anything from him. So,
okay.
Good morning, everyone. Am I on the main line here? It looks like I am. I think Monica Cochran was going to present, but we can make this a short one. We've been working hard to secure an additional site for homeless sheltering while we're in the COVID pandemic and social distancing. We don't have a site buttoned up, so really this is kind of a placeholder. We were hoping to have something more finalized here. I do have a quick update. We are planning to reopen the day use facility at Record Street, so folks have a place to go during the day, and continuing to work to secure a longer term site that's more suitable than the Reno Event Center for what appears to be a use that's going to need to continue for some time. None of us know when the COVID guidelines are going to end, but it's clearly going to be a while. So we're going to keep working on that. We'd like to report back at a future meeting. We are opening up the day use shelter. We're developing some contingency plans if we need to provide an alternative shelter site in effect before we get a longer term site identified. And really, that's kind of my non-update for the morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Arlo. Member Delgado.
Thank you, Chair. Arlo, really quick, when you say you guys are reopening the CAC Record Street, what does that mean? Are you having people stay over? Is it just, I think you just said day use, but just wanted for some clarity.
Well, there's presently some folks staying there right now, some veterans and special needs individuals. They would continue to stay overnight. But we're planning to open up the day use facility that's just outside of the center. So folks have somewhere to go during the day and a little less of just looking for a spot to find shade during the day. So that's the main change, is reopening the day use center.
Are you enforcing capacity numbers, or how's that working?
We are, and that's the biggest challenge with our COVID guidelines. We're way over capacity of that facility. That's fundamentally why we're using the Reno Event Center. And we need a much larger facility to be able to shelter folks while maintaining social distancing. So that's where a larger site comes into play.
Are there numbers that you can share with the group in terms of what that capacity number looks like and what it was, and then what you guys are trying to, you know, keep in line in terms of what the governor's asking?
At the peak, it was up 350, 375 being sheltered in the Reno Event Center. If we used every square inch of the building at Record Street, you know, on the ballpark of 100 people could be sheltered. So there's a significant gap there. We are looking at the possibility of an outside tent structure in the parking lot, but that would only get us another 100 people or so. So fundamentally, we need a larger site for the duration of the COVID guidelines to have shelter for everyone in need of shelter.
Sorry to keep asking, Chairwoman. So for the overflow shelter, what's the capacity number there? And are they providing programming there, or is it just they just stay the night?
This is Monica. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go. Monica should address these questions. I'll just mess it up.
Sorry, I was muted. The overflow shelter is being utilized by the county now for the women. We're not using it as an overflow shelter anymore, and it's a 24-hour facility. And I believe there's about 70 women there. I could be mistaken on that number, but I think that it's around that number. And with the day use area that we're opening back up, we've done some assessments. We've talked with fire building, and we figured that we could safely allow about 100 individuals to use that area during the day, just for somewhere to go and not have to be out on the streets.
So we're saying 100 day use at the CAC with people staying the night at the same number?
No, at right now, those they're still staying at the Reno Event Center.
Okay.
But that's just hope that the campus has been closed since COVID, except for a few people at a time to come on and use the restrooms or get mail, things like that. So okay. We're just going to open it up for people that are staying at the event center or somewhere for them to go during the day. And right. we believe that there's enough space for about 100 individuals. We had some temporary showers at that location, and we moved them on to the other side of the campus just to allow some more space for folks and, you know, allow for fire access and stuff like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are currently 75 women at the women's shelter. And a shout out to the work that was done there to house those women. I went through the day it was open and appreciate all the work that Lisa Lee and Rise and those and the county is doing on that facility while our place gets finished up. And I guess while we're on that subject, when do we anticipate that our place will be at a spot to take the women? I think I heard fall.
August 15th is the anticipated completion date for construction. August 15th.
Okay. Oh, good. Okay, that's great. And we did, interestingly, they did have pets, the women at the women's shelter, the overflow shelter. And I'm curious to get some feedback on how the pets worked out there. That could be a good sort of sample model to see. I know I did a call out for some of the little crates to maybe have the animals sleep in them at night, or maybe if the women had to go somewhere during the day. And I'm just curious how that, I know some other homeless facilities have used crates for pets, and I'm just curious how that went. So we can get that at a future meeting. So to Member Delgado's question, so we're gonna get an expanded, we'll call it expanded, use during the day of approximately 100 opening the day space. How many are staying at the Reno Event Center on average per night now?
Right now with the women relocating, it's about 225 to 250 men staying there on average. It was much higher when the weather was colder, but as the weather got warmer, we've seen a decline and we have a number of open beds every night.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
250. Yes, Member Bergbigler.
Thank you. The pets are going to be allowed at our place too when we move the women over there. And currently, as of this morning, there are 80 women there. So the number's gone up a little bit, but at least we're still protecting them and making sure they're safe from COVID. So thank you.
Thank you for that. Okay, so we've got 250 at the Record Street site.
One at the event center.
I'm sorry. At the event center. Okay, and it's only men there now.
Correct. We did have some conversations with the county if they got over capacity at the overflow shelter that we would allow women back at the event center so we weren't turning people away. I don't know that we've had to do that to this point, but we've had those conversations.
Okay. One of the things, and again, I won't jump ahead of myself about requesting a special meeting, but one of the concerns is how we are addressing the 250 that are in the Reno Event Center that need to be relocated as events are scheduled, even as early as this month in that facility. Businesses in the surrounding areas are trying to make a go of it, and we need to be having an alternate solution while the longer term, you know, piece of land and the safe camp and the additional shelter space is hopefully being worked out. We need to figure that out. And I will be asking for a special meeting on July the 20th to have that discussion to see where we're going to put these 250 individuals by August 1st, I would think at the latest, so we can get that facility back open to have events, even for staff for those downtown locations. We've got to get that facility back open, and we've got to find an alternate location. And I wonder what the viability is of the Edison Way trailers, with the understanding, with the clear understanding of the needs of security for that facility and what that would look like. That's 300 units, as I understand, that are sitting in, and we're going to have to find something out and quick. So I know this is an action item, but yes, Member Bunker.
Thank you. One other thing is, I know at one time in the past there was a lot of discussion about one of those very large tent structures, like similar to what were at the jail for overflow housing. And I believe Mr. Duffield from up in Incline Village had some that he was looking to get rid of. And I think Commissioner Hartung was working with that. Has anybody followed up on that? Do we know if those are still available? And if they are, one of the discussions perhaps we could have is where there might be a space that we could put that would be convenient to the homeless coming in. So maybe that's something else we want to talk about for the special meeting you're calling.
I think, and I don't want to talk out of turn, and we can of course discuss this further, is they deemed that tent was not viable, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Yeah. They did some research, and I appreciate Commissioner Hartung's. He worked very hard understanding the severity of this issue, and then I think they did some analysis of it, and the structure just isn't viable, from what I understand. But okay, do we have any additional member comments on this item at this time? Okay, seeing none, I know this is not an action item, but Madam Clerk, do we have any public comment?
Not on this item, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close item 9, move to item 10, board member announcements, reports, and updates to include requests for future board agenda items. Any members? Okay, seeing none. I am requesting, and if everybody can pull their phones out and their calendars, that we have a special meeting on Monday, July the 20th, 2 weeks from today, so we may discuss Safe Camp possibilities, their operations, their funding, and potential locations. And the second item is to discuss interim housing opportunities for those individuals at the Reno Event Center, up to and including the units on Edison Way or any other options available to us. Member Dare.
Sorry, I forgot. I do want to make sure, can we get Councilman Lawson mentioned it, and it's something we've talked about and agreed on, veterans and our youth. If we can get an update of what's happening, a lot has changed. A lot of COVID has changed a lot of things. And I've been trying to keep up with Eddie House personally, but I do know you have Monica DePee's group, who I think it'd be good to just kind of get a touch of those two areas. They are our best investment of time and effort, in the sense of seeing them see a shift. And so we'd love to see what's happening. And even with the veteran population, who the right person is there.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think my point of contact for the city of Reno, now as the chair, will be Arlo. Is that correct, Arlo?
Yes.
Okay. Just clarification for these future meetings. So, Arlo, you got the notes on a special meeting July the 20th to discuss Safe Camps, including the information and the research done on their viability in other communities and details of that, as well as our opportunities for the men's shelter moving out of the Reno Event Center by August 1st, and where that location for them may be during this COVID time for adequate spacing. And that to include Built for Zero in attendance at that meeting as well. I think they're imperative in some of the data collection that we get. So July the 20th is two Mondays from now, correct?
Right, Madam Chair.
Yes, Member Burke.
Let me just give Commissioner Dare some information there. Our place is going to have a 50-bed building for teens, And that will be complementary to the 50 beds that are available in the other center, Eddie House. So I know we have several places. We are working with the teens at our place also. So there's going to be some definite work there. So we do need probably a report on it, but I think we can ask Amber, because I know she's been working, Amber Howell, she's been working not only on the Our Place 50 bed unit, but also working with Eddie House on tying together all the issues that relate to homeless teens. So that is being looked at. And Madam Chair, one other thing, I can do the 20th, but I have a 9:30 doctor's appointment, so I'll have to work around it.
Okay, thank you. All right, do we have any other members that have any announcements or future agenda items? Okay, seeing none, moving on, is there any public comment on this issue?
On agenda item 10?
Or
11, have we moved
10. To? Yeah, I'm on 10, but I don't think there would be public comment on this, but.
No, you don't. Sorry, Madam Chair, this is Dave Watsby. You don't take public comment on item 10, but you do have the general public comment coming up next.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close item 10 at this time. Moving on to item 11, our closing general public comment. Madam Clerk.
I have no emails. Do we have any Zoom public comment?
We do.
One Zoom public comment.
Jay Colbert.
Clausel. Okay. Hello, this is Jay Colbert Clausel for the record. I just wanted to draw attention to the name that the women have or are calling the former overflow shelter. They're calling it Our Place to Grow. So that was, they're all meeting and have a little committee set up. RISE is going to have some funding available, so they get to decide how to spend that to improve the service and help them get to the next step. But the name that they are using is Our Place to Grow.
Great.
And that was all, thank you.
Thanks, Jay. Okay, Madam Clerk, any further public comment?
Is there anyone else on Zoom? We're checking, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
There is no one else on Zoom and I have no emails.
Thank you very much. All right, everybody, I appreciate all your time. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you all on the 20th. I may get a motion to adjourn. Nobody wants to leave.
Who to adjourn?
I do. Second.
I have a motion to second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Goodbye.
Motion carries unanimously. Thanks, everybody.
Good job.
Thank you.